This is not technically a Church of Christ building. There's no clock in the back. But there is a sniper, which makes it a Texas church. And that's good. There's some things that we learn about ministers. Some of it I know myself. A lot of it I know myself. I think everything I'm going to tell you I know myself. But it's odd when you after being in 13 years of ministry with ministers and their families, and after having hundreds of couples go through our minister support network process, to hear these lessons reinforced, to hear them again. And so this isn't just the gospel according to Eddie today, but this is what we hear. And it's something that we wanted to turn the volume up on. Now, you have all these slides and all of this, and so you could have already read the book and you're not sure you want to see the movie, but hang with me if you will. One of the things that Charlie says in one of his presentations is that ministers are driven perhaps more than anything else by guilt and shame. Now, I don't know if you know how that works, but I know how that works a little bit in my own life. I remember what I was like when I was in high school and I had just been on some cavort and been found out in it, which is my luck always. And I remember thinking, I know I want to be a physicist, but if I become a physicist, I will go to hell. And if I become a minister, I'll have a chance of being saved. And there is this sense sometimes, even in the most grace-based minister, that kind of like the widow lady who's trying to make enough casseroles to go to heaven. If you're a minister, maybe you can preach long enough or well enough, or in vulnerable enough positions that maybe God will love you a bit. And in that, there is that sense that if you really knew us, you wouldn't like us as much as you think you do right now. If you really knew us. If you knew that when we were kids, we learned all those words you shouldn't say. And that when we are in traffic and somebody cuts us off, we don't always just recite the Lord's Prayer. It is, it's scary, really, to think of all the ways in which needing to be perceived as just pretty good drives us. And to hear the load that we'll say some more about that, but often we are driven by guilt because we've been guilty, and often we are driven by shame because we've done things that were shameful. But our task, as Charlie also reminds us, is to believe the grace that we preach and to believe it for ourselves. And you need to know that as ministers, often that is a great task, to believe the grace that we preach to you. And so as we come to our elders, one of the things that we hope to find is not another judge and jury, because we have one of those often in our own heart. But what we hope to find are others who are experienced with their own guilts and their own shames and are willing to be fellow travelers on a journey from grace to grace and then again to grace. And so that's a task, I think, as elders and ministers sit down together to have that sense of grace about them. Ministers are lonely. Why would they be lonely? Look, there's all those people out there. And all, after church, everybody wants to talk to them. And goodness knows How would they ever be lonely? But we hear them. We hear ministers talk about the isolation in which they work. The isolation that grows out of, nobody really knows exactly what it is to do what I do. Nobody actually knows what it is to have a congregation of people in your mind and the text open in front of you and to be wrestling through years and months of preaching, trying to discern what it is that God's Word needs to say today. And Moses crosses the river with hundreds of thousands of people and finds himself off and alone. And Jesus is stalked every day by multitudes and finds himself occasionally alone. Those were the good days, I think. And it's a minister of some maturity and with good shepherds who learns to live from loneliness into solitude and to not be driven by loneliness into false community, but to have enough security within to be in healthy fellowships and prayer groups and places like that. I was talking to a minister the other day who, because of his own father and all the dynamics in his family, said, I don't like being in groups of men, especially men about the age of his father. And I wonder, how did you ever get in the ministry like that? He's isolated. Alone. I think this is the one thing that leaders in churches probably never quite unpack for ministers. Just the isolation of it. But part of that comes from the vulnerability of preaching. You never know when you're done. You have this job. You kind of are supported by the church, but you never know when. That Sunday you forget to put the blood on the doorpost and you find out how to pack that 24-foot U-Haul again. And how did this wiring go the last time I did it to the hitch to make sure the brake lights come on the car? It's vulnerable. It's a vulnerable job and it can be lonesome. Ministers often appear as these isolates. I stand up here. Now, you don't know, as I stand up here, that I have this wife named Annette. Ministers should not work without Annette. It is true. Because otherwise, you just splat. You need to know that this morning, Annette has the joy of having my parents visiting in our house. And you don't know the joy that is for her. And our grandson is going to come over sometime this morning, and our son is here. And I have a son who was a part of a very important element inside Austin ISD, but all 18 of those people have lost their jobs in a budget-cutting move. Now people are calling him and saying, are y'all the people that did this for all the schools? Yeah, we did that. Y'all aren't here anymore? No, we're not here anymore. Why did you? Well, and in that position, everybody else, 15 people have found jobs and 3 people haven't. The director and the 2 assistant directors, the director, the lady in the office, and my son is still interviewing. And so there is, a lot of stuff. My daughter is dating a guy. She's 33 and this family practice doc, and she's dating this guy, and he's in my brain. Not just because his name is Travis or he's from Georgia, but he's another doctor. And now I'll have two people there at the end going, yeah, I think we can unplug it. And I've got a younger son who, he doesn't have kids yet. He got this nice wife. And he's just Eeyore in search of his tail. You know, Eeyore's always out of sorts when he can't find his tail. And that's Scott. He's just very Eeyore-ish. And we're hoping his wife can put up with him until he finds his tail at least. Because I got a feeling someday she'd love to tack it back on for him. And you have these families, and when you're a minister and all this stuff is going on, it's really great if you have this sense that somebody not only cares about me, but cares about my family. These guys that are back here on this row, these three elders that I have, they ask me about my family. They ask me about my family from the very first day that we started even talking about coming to Austin, they were interested in our family. And so, and that matters. It's tough when a church seems to only care about the minister for the services he provides. That feels like a pretty shallow end of the pool to get in. And ministers cannot read minds. I know what you're thinking. That we, I don't really. I don't really. Here's the thing that's come up several times in one of our retreats. A guy would say, yeah, about 6 months ago, one of the elders took me out to lunch, and he mentioned three or four things that he was thinking about. But then 2 weeks ago, they called me in, and they said, I was done. And I said, why? And they said, because we talked to you about this, and this, and this, and this, and you didn't do anything about it. And he said, when did you talk to me about that? He said, well, when this one elder came and had lunch with you that day. And the guy goes, I thought that was one elder. I thought he was just telling me four or five things he had thought of while he had indigestion one day. While he was in a grumpy phase. He never said anything more about it. I didn't know that was from all the elders. And they said, well, you should have known. Should have known. And at the point we're talking to him, he's all roadmaps and resumes. You know, he's looking. Because it's done. But after you do the autopsy on that, and he's laid out on the table with that little Y across his chest, and you look at what went on, it would have been nice if somebody would have said, we're having lunch, and you're having egg salad, and I'm having you for lunch. Because I'm here on behalf of the 25 elders back at the church, and we have been talking, and I am now talking to you on their behalf, and here are some things we would like for you to address. And this is from all of the elders, and we need you to do something about this. And we're going to meet with you again. Here are the elders that are assigned to continue to meet with you about this. We're looking for about a 6 month time for progress on this. We're going to meet with you here in a little bit later. We believe that you can do this. Now, if you can't, these are vital enough to us that if you can't help us with this, we may need to find somebody who can, but at least we want you to know what we're thinking. Well, at that point, I don't want to finish lunch, but at least I know what's up. Now, Hugh, if Monday night I get Eddie, we need to have lunch. And by the way, I'll know what's going on anyway. Okay, I'll know. I put this down. They need shepherds who will talk like the girls and the guys. Maybe I ought to tell you about that if I have a minute, and I've got more than that, so that's good. Communication is a part of the difficult part in any kind of ministry. I was doing some premarital counseling on Wednesday night, and I was telling this sweet young couple that a little conflict is just the sign that you're getting closer. And when you get a little conflict in a marriage, you can decide, we'll back off and not have any more conflict, and you'll be stuck that far apart the rest of your life, or you can resolve the communication difficulties and you can continue getting closer. And they looked at each other and said there in their premarital bliss, oh, we want to get lots closer. We'll see. We'll see. But as a part of that, I always try to tell people about how the girls talk to the girls and how guys talk. And so I'm just going to throw this in because you might want to know. Guys talk usually in order to fix something. They like to fix things. They like to fix things before they know exactly what's wrong. The other day I bought a table to use. I bought it at IKEA, and I went home and I put the legs on it, and I had to put 16 screws through the bottom of the table to anchor the legs. And when I turned the table over, I had to pull it out of the carpet because I had screwed all the way through the top of the table 16 times. And I thought, I should go back through those instructions and go buy a new tabletop. And guys like to interrupt each other. This Deborah Tannen says that guys talk in the style, first me, then me. That they talk about something and then they let the other person talk until they hear something they want to say, referred to, and then they interrupt. And they talk. And if you are with a bunch of guys, you listen to them, nobody ever gets through saying anything. It's like a relay. First me, then me. Women talk to each other because women like to hear the whole story. They like to read the instructions. They like to understand what's going on. And they have a style called first me, then you. They talk to each other, and they talk, they say, they get it all out, and when there's a little pause, then the other woman goes, now I can tell mine. And they talk. And then they talk. And they boom, boom, boom. This is why when women and men get together, sometimes it's very ugly. The woman feels like she never gets to talk and say what she wants to say because he keeps interrupting to go back and talk about something he wants to talk about, because after all, it's first him, then him. Both of these styles are pretty good. And there are times in church when you need to get onto the solution, and the guys interrupt their way to finding the solution. But there are some times when somebody needs to come up to me and say, so tell me about this, and they let me tell the whole story. Without interrupting me to tell me how that somehow reminds them of a fly fishing trip to Montana. I don't really understand how that could have related to your interruption. I can't read your mind, and you can't read mine. Would we ever get a chance to actually talk? And do you have the time to listen? If I have the time to listen to you. Well, the fifth one is, this is the hardest one for me. Ministers are not going to be good at everything. This last week, spent a little time talking about our search for a youth minister. On it, we have this sheet that talks about all the qualities we'd like to have for a youth minister. young, mature. Able to get on well with eighth graders. Able to keep a budget. You haven't had many youth ministers. That was even funnier than the other one. But when you get all the way down through there, you expect somewhere down there, able to fly. Able to lay golden eggs. The qualities, and you can't find a single character in the Bible who would be able to do all of those things. And you want to hire that guy for the least amount of money. If you could find that guy would be worth all you could pay him. But he'd be too smart to work for you. We like to have this sense that as churches, we're looking for the person that can do it all. And as ministers, when we come to you, we want to come to you with a resume that basically says, in so many words, the second coming. As good as Jesus, only with a great wife. And going back to the guilt and shame part of it, what drives us crazy is that you will find out it's not true. But it's really fair. Churches lie to us about what they are too. And so then you have this little dance. The church thought to be perfect by the minister who was thought to be perfect. Dancing around, hoping that neither one of them find out the truth. Because the imperfect church, in the presence of the imperfect ministers, what hope do they have? They'll just have to hope in the Lord, I guess. They might have to pray. They might have to ask for spiritual gifts. They might, who knows what would happen if the imperfect church and the imperfect ministers all met and didn't have a U-Haul party. So, I wonder what it happens if you walk into a meeting with your elders and they sit down with you and go, "Hail to thee, imperfect one. We've been looking at your ministry lately and we find it to be imperfect. There appear to be things that aren't getting done and you're the person not doing them. And we want you to know that we're an imperfect church and imperfect elders, and we're going to love you for your strengths and understand your weaknesses, and we're not going to hate you because of the weaknesses you have." Well, if this is the way ministers are, I mean, this is like turning over. It's like finding a minister, like a board, and you turn it over, and there's all those bugs underneath. He's insecure in many ways. He's lonesome. Look at all he is. Ew. I think I'll just go to the television and watch that slick guy out of Houston. Evidently, something's wrong about the Word becoming flesh. There's something missing. What if imperfect is as good as it gets? It is. But what if all the things we've said about ministers are also true about elders? Wouldn't that be crazy? Yeah, I think so. What if elders are feeling down in their hearts that they want things to be perfect in the church? And what if elders have a dark side of their life they would prefer to hide and may compensate by being hyper-perfectionistic? What if that were true? What if they needed somebody to walk along with them? What if elders were lonely? What if the burden of being a shepherd of God's people was almost overwhelming. Until you thought about it, and then it was overwhelming. What if you need someone to be your friend too? What if elders had families? There would be something. What if elders had families and they had wives who were occasionally wonderful and sometimes difficult, sometimes, well, occasionally sick? What if their believing children occasionally threw them an unbelievable curve? Would it be okay to have shepherds who were sensitive? Ministers who were sensitive to the family burdens of the shepherds. What if an elder can't read a preacher's mind either and wouldn't want to, but even if they wanted to? What if elders need a preacher who will talk to them clearly about what he hopes and what he dreams, about what sticks in his craw and what doesn't? What if the elders need preacher who won't just act like he's a prima donna and he knows everything automatically? What if elders aren't going to be good at everything? What if some elders you have are good? What if one elder's good at one thing and another elder's really good at something else? What if one guy's a really good pastoral elder and this elder's a really good hospital elder, and over this elder over here, he's a really good dollars and cents elder? Do all the elders have to be clones of one another? Just one prototype elder? And what if they need ministers around them who don't despise them for their incapacities? And what if that's as good as it gets? So which one of these things do you need to remember about your minister? Which one of these? The shame, the guilt, the loneliness, the family, the mind reading. What is it that you need to remember? There's probably one. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about now just briefly and then talk about more in a little bit, is that, you see, what I think down in my heart of hearts, I don't know where that is. People talk about that. I just got one. Is I really think that churches do well when ministers and elders treat each other like they're the church within the church. No, not that they're the super church within the ordinary church, but that in that primary circle of fellowship, if there can be good nurturing there, then the rest of the church has a chance. That all of the skills of shepherding and nurturing and building up that you would expect to have go on in the church should happen there. Because if the ministers can be healthy and the elders can be healthy, then the rest of the church has a chance. But the life of the church will never be healthier than the nature of those relationships. So God bless us as we go forward with all that. God bless us as we go forward. We'll talk about some more about this afternoon. We talk about an alliance of gifts. All right? Bless your hearts. What you're doing is not easy. Boy, it's not easy. And in the church, there are some interesting folks, aren't there? Some of the ministers that come to the MSN, we look at them and go, really? And some of the elders that some of the folks describe, we go, really? I tell people there are two things you don't want to be. You don't want to be, Eddie's a good man, but. Or that church he preaches for, bless their heart.